some big news today from corporate America. Southwest Airlines reported a record profit in its second quarter earnings report, and the company is giving each of its workers a $200 bonus to thank them. American Airlines Group also had record profits. The company's earnings were up significantly from last year before American and U.S. Airways merged, and American announced its first dividend since 1980. And the machinery giant Caterpillar reported higher profits than expected, thanks in part to a slight uptick in the company's mining business.
So good news for some businesses in capital-intensive industries, but their earnings reports really can't hold a candle to the news from Facebook.
This quarter, our total revenue grew to over $2.9 billion, and advertising revenue grew by 67% from a year ago.
That's Facebook chief executive Mark Zuckerberg speaking on a conference call with investors yesterday. And the social network's robust numbers come largely from its dominance in mobile, which leads The Atlantic's Derek Thompson to proclaim, in a headline, that Facebook is eating mobile. Derek's with us now. Welcome back to the show.
Good to be here.
So chomp, 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 chomp goes the Facebook machine. Why are they doing so well with mobile marketing?
I think this is more than Facebook being a turnaround story. I think this is the most successful advertising story of our time. 2 years ago, Facebook's IPO flopped because the company had to acknowledge that it barely had a business plan on mobile. They barely knew how to sell ads on mobile. Now, Facebook is selling more ads than Time Warner and Viacom combined. That means you put together all the ad revenue from CNN, TBS, TNT, Nickelodeon, MTV, Comedy Central. Facebook is richer than all of that. And it's all because they have figured out how to advertise on our mobile devices.
And it's quite an amazing amount of growth. I see one research firm saying that Facebook in 2013 captured almost 18% of all mobile ad spending. They expect that number to jump to more than 22% of all mobile ad revenue this year. I mean, do we know what their secret sauce is other than the fact that they have more than a billion users, so they just have a really huge user base?
That is absolutely a part of it. Scale is huge. I think that everybody has the same problem on mobile, and that problem is the screen. Advertisers want people to see their stuff. And so television, which has sometimes 50, 70-inch screens, is a great place to see stuff. Beautiful magazine pages, a wonderful place to see a Cartier ad. But mobile devices don't have that. So you don't have size. You need something else. And Facebook has that. First, it has this wonderful simplicity. It's just a single-column cascading product, its newsfeed, that it can easily slip in ads into. Second, it knows to a degree that basically nobody else does who we are, what we like, and whom we know. And so they can give us ads that are sort of ideally within context. They can show us things that we've indicated that we like or our friends have indicated that we like. Third, because it knows so well who we are, they can run these incredibly sophisticated experiments to tell advertisers exactly how many extra widgets their advertising is making us buy. Nobody has all of these things combined, and that's why I think the future of mobile advertising is basically going to be Facebook and then Google, where we basically tell our phones what we want and Google can advertise something next to that.
So the hard-bitten journalist in me is now thinking that Big Brother isn't just watching you, but he has something to sell to you. But on the other hand, you mentioned Google, and that's a serious point. If you're Google right now and you see this 60-plus percent jump in mobile ad revenue from Facebook in 1 year, what are you thinking?
I'm thinking I'm really, really lucky that I have such a wonderful product in search, because when we are on our phones, I think we're on our phones for maybe say two reasons often. One is to look for something, figure out where you want to have lunch, figure out where the deals are in your area. This is Google. Google owns search. We're at the bottom of the purchase funnel. We're basically saying, I want to buy this thing. And so advertisers spend a lot of money to put their stuff right in front of our faces at the moment we're willing to make a purchase. That's Google's trump card. Facebook's trump card is different, but it's just as special. It's we know exactly who you are, who your friends are, what you like, and because we know who you are, we can run these experiments to show advertisers exactly how valuable their advertising is on a person-by-person basis. And so I think that what you're looking at is a two-man race. I think that you have a lot of publishers, a lot of companies trying to figure out the mobile game. And if you ask me, the mobile game is just a duumvirate in the next few years. It's just Google and Facebook eating more of this mobile pie. I don't know how to stop it.
Yeah. Well, in the last couple seconds we have, Derek, did Mark Zuckerberg give investors any indication of what they're going to do next? I mean, they've got a lot of cash. They've got some time. They're proving that things can work. So what are their next steps?
Facebook spent a lot of money on betting on the future. They spent a lot of money on Instagram, and Instagram has become a lot more popular since they bought it for $1 billion. They spent a lot of money on WhatsApp, and they've invested both in people and in product for texting, which might be sort of the new frontier of social media. And they spent a lot of money on Oculus Rift, which is this really weird but quite amazing virtual reality system. So Facebook's essentially saying, we're rich enough for now. We have a crazy profit margin. Let's make some interesting bets in the future. Let's make some interesting bets on where media is going to go in the next few years. I don't know what it's going to be, but their portfolio is pretty diverse.
Derek Thompson is with The Atlantic talking to us about Facebook's dazzling revenue numbers just out. Thanks so much, Derek.
Thank you.
Well, the federal agency responsible for marine endangered species announced this week it is considering a ban on recreational and commercial fishing for Pacific bluefin tuna. Scientists say the species stands at less than 5% of its historic numbers. And it may not be that we in America are the ones eating it. Much of the seafood caught here is sent abroad, and much of the seafood caught abroad is sent here. And that bothers author Paul Greenberg, whose new book is called American Catch, The Fight for Our Local Seafood. He joins us now. Paul Greenberg, welcome to Here and Now.
Hey, thanks, Jeremy.
And when we say local seafood, one of the things that is so shocking in this book is that 90% of the seafood we eat in the U.S. is now imported, even though we ourselves are exporting a whole lot of our own seafood.
That's right. I mean, we're sending abroad about a third of what we catch, and that's around 3 billion pounds of seafood. So it's a conundrum.
And why are we doing that?
It boils down a lot to price. Americans do not like to pay a lot for their food in general, and their seafood in particular, they're not so interested in paying a lot of money for. So the seafood that we're importing, generally speaking, is pretty low-end stuff. Shrimp, which is, you know, by far the most consumed seafood in America, we eat almost as much shrimp as tuna and salmon, the next two most popular combined. It's also a lot of tilapia, and it's also a fish that most people don't even know about called the Pangasius catfish. Hmm. They're all real cheap. And what we're exporting are really high-value things, a lot of salmon, black cod, which, you know, Nobu famously made into his black cod with miso dish. You know, that might be fine on the tables of Nobu, but how many Americans actually get there? Meanwhile, back in Japan and China and other places in Asia, they like really good wild fish, and they're ready to pay the good money for it.
Well, and as you write, the fact that we do that, that we have that strange swap where we're sending seafood overseas and also bringing in seafood here, okay, fine, that's what we're doing. But it's also causing environmental problems right here in the U.S. that aren't about just all the diesel that's used to ship that stuff overseas.
Right. No, what I think it's doing is it's effectively detaching the American citizen from his or her own coast. You know, you look back at what we did have in terms of seafood infrastructure 100-odd years ago. This country was one of the world, if not the world's largest producer of oysters. New York City produced many, many millions of pounds of oysters. And the average New Yorker, as recently as 1920, ate 600 local New York City oysters a year.
Yeah.
Now they eat zero. What that to me indicates is that we've abandoned a lot of waterways as food systems, and instead we've turned them kind of into waste disposal systems. So all over the East Coast, there are estuaries that really should be seafood systems, but they're not anymore, precisely because now we can rely on things like cheap Asian shrimp to supply something that, you know, our estuaries should be supplying here at home.
Well, and you talk a lot in this book about those oysters in New York, oysters that there used to be, you say, trillions of them in and around New York City. And now there are almost none.
Yeah, I mean, there were trillions and trillions. They turned over the water column every few weeks, you know, because one oyster can filter 50 gallons of water in a single day. So imagine when there are trillions of them, you know, you would have a much cleaner marine environment. Today, it should be said that it isn't all our fault right here and now. No pun intended. Our ancestors who really did the serious damage to the wild oyster reefs of New York City. The original Dutch colonists and then the British after them came to New York and they found these huge oyster reefs and they just mined them out very, very quickly so that by 1820, the wild oyster reefs of New York City were gone. But what happened after that was that you had this tremendous blooming of an oyster farming industry, the very first aquaculture that we really did. And it grew and grew and grew. We were growing 2 billion pounds of oysters every single year, a huge, huge resource. You know, there's an old Yiddish expression, don't poop where you eat. It's a little cruder in its off-air model. But that's essentially what we did in New York. We turned New York Harbor into an open sewage system. 600 million gallons of sewage went into the waters of New York City every day, if you can believe it. And then beyond that, once we started to associate oysters with disease that this very sewage was causing, then we were like, oh, forget about it. And we dumped everything in. All sorts of industrial chemicals went into New York Harbor. Dioxins from the manufacture of Agent Orange even went into New York City estuaries. It's just kind of amazing.
Well, and it becomes a vicious circle because once you dump all of that into the water and the oysters can't live there, you lose the filtration system as well.
That's right. And, I think I say in the book somewhere that there's no more intimate relationship you can have with your environment than to eat from it. Once we stopped eating from the environment in New York City, we really let the environment go to hell. My fear is, you know, it's not like we're not going to see New York oysters on the menu anytime soon, perhaps never, perhaps not in my lifetime. But this kind of process is happening in coastal systems all around the country. And, you know, we have to at a certain point say, stop it. This is a food system. It's not just a system to hold our wastewater. It is actually a food system that we need to protect.
And you write in your book that the people trying to do that got very close. And then in 2010, something happened and it involved the newly elected governor of New Jersey, Chris Christie. Tell us what happened.
New York Harbor is split in ownership between New York and New Jersey. And on the New York side, they were having a lot of conflicts with municipal authorities about trying to reintroduce oysters, precisely because people were worried that if you put oysters back into the water, somebody might, oh my God, eat them. And then they might get sick and then some city authority would get blamed. Well, they had all these problems on the New York side, so they decided to really focus their efforts on the New Jersey side. And things went swimmingly. They were really progressing. They started a project in Keyport Harbor, which is in view of the New York City skyline, and it was going pretty well. But then the administration changed. Chris Christie came in. But his new environmental administration did not like this oyster restoration experiment. One day, the DEC came in and basically said, you got to shut this down. We do not want market-sized oysters growing within the range of where humans could potentially harvest them. And they made the organization that put them there, New York, New Jersey Baykeeper, haul out this multi-thousand-dollar project of oyster restoration, hauled them out onto the shore and sit there and watched while they chipped the oysters off of the reef balls and threw them in a dumpster.
This was because there's a strong oyster industry off the Jersey Shore.
Yeah, I mean, so New Jersey is a kind of two states. Southern Jersey is a huge shellfish producer, produces a lot of oysters, blue crab, all kinds of things are grown and thrive in New Jersey waters. And oystermen down south seem to have been really nervous about the idea of New York City oysters appearing again. Their worry was that, well, what if a New York City oyster, even though it wasn't meant to be eaten, it was only for restoration purposes, but what if one of those oysters were to make its way into the greater New Jersey shellfish supply and somebody were to get sick? What if that happened? Then they might shut us all down. There's a huge amount of fear around seafood in general. There was one producer in the book that I quoted who said that, you know, somebody gets sick eating a lobster in Florida and people are going to stop eating clams in Maine.
Paul Greenberg, I love seafood. I love to eat it. And I wonder, when I go into the store to buy some, is there any way to really get sustainable seafood, even if you're buying locally?
So there are a number of new entities coming into being, which are called community supported fisheries, or CSFs. It's kind of equivalent to like a CSA is, you know, with A being agriculture. You can buy a share from these CSFs at the outset of the season, and they will provide for you a share of their catch throughout the fishing season. And what's great for you is that, you know, you have traceability. You know that this fisherman is providing the fish that was caught in their local waters.
But if somebody is going to the supermarket and buying salmon that is farmed, you know, in Asia, is that a problem? Are they doing something bad for the environment?
Well, first of all, there's not to my knowledge, really salmon being farmed in Asia. Most of the salmon that's coming to us from Asia, and this is weird, it's wild Alaska salmon that we catch in Alaska. We freeze it. We send it to China or to Thailand or wherever. It's defrosted, boned, filleted, and frozen again, and then sent back to us. It's twice frozen.
That makes a lot of sense, yeah.
Yeah, you know, there's the salmon out there that have more frequent flyer miles than I do. actually, they go by boat, if we want to be serious. I think that you have to think about your seafood choices based on the reputation of the seller. There is a Greenpeace report called Carting Away the Oceans, where they went through and essentially audited supermarkets in the United States to determine who had the best seafood buying policies. And I believe at the top you had Whole Foods and Wegmans and Safeway. And recently, after they made some changes, Trader Joe's actually, I think, is in the number four spot. You know, it's seafood is tricky. And, you know, a major thing I would call for in this country is we need much better seafood labeling. We need to know where the fish was caught. We need to know where it was processed. Because one really crazy thing is that you can have a fish that, say, is grown in China. The fish comes over here. If we turn it into a fish stick and then export it, it is called product of the USA.
Even though it was grown in China.
Correct.
But we're also doing bad things to the fish that is grown here and sold here. And I'm talking about the overfishing of cod in the Northeast, for example.
Yeah. I mean, we have to be a little careful, I think, when we use the term overfishing, not because it's not real. It is very real. But because this country has done considerable things to try to solve its overfishing problem. In 1996, there was an addenda put on to the Magnuson-Stevens Act called the Sustainable Fisheries Act, which defined overfishing for the first time really and mandated the rebuilding of all American wild stocks. And this is essentially what's been going on for the last 20 years, to the point where we now have about 30 stocks that have been rebuilt, you know, though some people take issues with the benchmark of rebuilding. And there, you know, many fish are coming back. Now, Atlantic cod, Georges Bank cod, Gulf of Maine cod, not coming back the way we had hoped.
Paul Greenberg, you've been all over the place with this book. It's been doing very well. And public radio listeners have probably already heard you in other places. Is there something that you found while putting this together that you haven't been asked about and that you're surprised you haven't been asked about?
One of the things that people don't seem to be focusing on is the very, very strong ecological issue at the center of the book, which is the loss of this kind of unknown ecosystem called a salt marsh. Salt marshes are at the margins between fresh and salt in our estuarian environments. And they're marshy and they're mucky and they're yucky and they smell bad. But they are actually amazing. An acre of salt marsh sequesters more carbon than any other ecosystem on Earth, even more than, say, a tropical rainforest. Mm. And in addition to that, 70% of our seafood requires a salt marsh for some point in its life. And we've seen epic loss of salt marsh, something like 70-80%. And, you know, I almost wanted to do a T-shirt that would, you know, would say, it's the salt marsh, stupid. you know, people focus on overfishing. Overfishing is important. But essential marine habitat, something that the people at NOAA talk about a lot, is just that. It is essential. And we need to restore salt marsh. We need to stop losing salt marsh and just say salt marsh, salt marsh, salt marsh over and over again until the message sinks in.
Paul Greenberg is the author of American Catch, The Fight for Our Local Seafood. And we've got more at our website, hereandnow.org. Paul Greenberg, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks so much, Jeremy.
You might label our next story sour grapes. It's about an elaborate scam involving wine and some of America's wealthiest wine collectors. And the scammer, Rudy Kerniawan, was convicted of fraud for selling millions of dollars of phony vintages he concocted in his kitchen. The BBC's Michelle Fleury reports.
Thank you. Wine enthusiasts have been known to spend tens of thousands of dollars at auctions, all to get their hands on a rare vintage. But what happens when your $1,000 bottle of rare Burgundy turns out to be cheap blanc?
Fair warning. One more chance. Last chance.
Around 2002, someone appeared on the rare wine scene who quickly became its golden boy. Little was known about him other than he was born in Indonesia and had access to rare vintages that no one else could find. His name was Rudy Kerniawan.
In the end, I would say Rudy Kerniawan was a master swindler.
To journalist Peter Hellman, who helped break the story in the magazine Wine Spectator, he's not just a crook, he's also an artist.
Rudy took pride in putting in the bottle wine which was very close to the real thing, if not better than the real thing. He would combine very old wines with younger wines in a way that you felt, oh my goodness, this 70-year-old wine is youthful, you know, and full of aromas and perfume, and my God, it's got a lovely mouthfeel.
For 8 years, he fooled industry experts and collectors. In 2006 alone, he sold more than $35 million worth of rare vintages. The hoax only began to unravel after a French wine producer accused him of selling fake versions of the family's wines.
Inside the wine crime of the century.
Billionaires and millionaires spending big on bottles of wine.
His trial attracted plenty of attention. Rudy Kerniawan was the first person in America to be convicted of wine fraud. Despite the media coverage, many of his deep-pocketed victims have chosen to keep quiet. But not all of them.
A pigeon, a sucker, whatever they call the mark.
It's not every day you hear a billionaire admit to being ripped off. But Bill Koch, whose brothers are known for funding conservative causes in the US, isn't your typical rare wine collector.
We have 12,000 bottles in here. That's a fake. Here's another one. I spent close to $5 million, and it's all fake.
You could call it the grapes of wrath. Bill Koch has started a very public campaign, pursuing those he suspects are wine counterfeiters through the courts. He even took the stand during Rudy Kerniawan's trial.
I cannot stand to be cheated. That I want someone to know, they sell me a fake, man, I'm coming after him, no matter how much it cost.
Well, I keep part of my collection here. And we store people's wines who live in New York City.
Jeffrey Troy is a New York wine merchant and an expert on Burgundy, who played a role in Rudy's eventual downfall.
He bought a lot of the great and new release wines from us.
And he spent a lot of money with you?
A fortune.
Yet based on the wines Rudy was buying from him, Jeffrey Troy had doubts.
I suspected that he could possibly be using them to change the vintage and sell them for a lot more money.
How damaging is this to your industry?
It's a terrible thing. I like to use the analogy that we're in a small village and we have one communal well. And once the well gets poisoned, everybody drinks the poisoned water.
That report from the BBC's Michelle Fleury.
Suicide and mental health are the top issues facing veterans who served in Iraq and Afghanistan. That's according to a survey released today by Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America, the first and largest organization for new veterans and their families. 40% of the vets who responded to the survey said they know at least one veteran of the Iraq or Afghanistan wars who has died by suicide. 30% say they themselves have thought about committing suicide since joining the military. Paul Rykoff is founder and CEO of Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America. He's a veteran of the Iraq War himself, and he's with us now. Paul, welcome back.
Thanks for having me. Great to be here.
Well, that number is really staggering. In fact, this one even more so. An estimated 22 veterans kill themselves every day. Is that statistic getting better or worse?
It looks like it's getting worse. And this entire survey should really be a wake-up call for all Americans. You know, this is all being released in the backdrop of the VA scandal. Right now, the VA is having tremendous turmoil. Our veterans are suffering. And we wanted to release the survey to show the true voice of our veterans. We've got over 200,000 members around the country. And we really need to understand the ground truth on mental health and on a variety of other issues. But if you think about it, almost half of our folks know someone close to them who has attempted suicide. That's a huge number. Every time I'm on the road, I'm meeting veterans who have been personally impacted, and this is a legitimate public health crisis. And we really need more help from Washington, from local municipalities, from philanthropy, from all Americans.
Well, and I see that 53% of respondents to the survey indicated that they have a mental health injury as well. You're actually pushing some legislation that's been introduced in the House to deal with this. What would that do?
Well, it would expand the mental health provider services. It would review all the existing mental health programs. It would demand that they incentivize mental health providers. We know there's been a shortage of doctors at the VA. And it's named after one of our own, a young Marine named Clay Hunt that we lost to suicide in Texas a few years ago. And his mother told his story. She powerfully testified before Congress a few weeks ago to try to put a human face on this, because that's really what it's about. It's not just about statistics and data. It's about real men and women that we are losing every single day. And we look for historical comparisons. There may not be a generation of young Americans that's lost so many of their friends close to them since the initial days of the AIDS crisis. This is happening all around us, and we need the country's help.
Another huge issue for veterans who responded to your survey is jobs. 10% of the vets said they didn't have jobs. How is that changing, and why is it so difficult for veterans returning from Iraq and Afghanistan especially to try and get employment when they come home?
Well, there has been a national call, and the First Lady and numerous corporations have started to focus on veterans' employment. We've made some headway, but 1 in 10 are coming home without jobs, and many of them are underemployed. About 77% said they had some kind of unemployment period. So the transition can be difficult. Their skills don't translate. People are worried they may redeploy. And we want folks to understand this is not about charity. This is about an investment. Invest in these young men and women. They're going to be good for your business. They're going to be dynamic, hardworking, and they're also incredibly entrepreneurial. I'm here in Boston today with a guy who just less than a year ago started a business in Worcester, and he's hired 30 people. Veterans start businesses and hire other veterans.
Well, why do you think more people aren't doing that then?
You know, I think there are some barriers in place for these folks. They've been gone on and off for 10 years, some of them, sometimes more, 5, 6 deployments. Many of them were in college. That's a good news story coming out of this, is over 1 million of our folks have used the GI Bill, and that's educating them, and now they're hitting the workforce. But at the end of the day, Americans have to understand the value of a veteran as a business proposition, not just as a charitable component, but something that can really propel your business no matter what you do forward.
If you look at how veterans in this survey view the people in Washington, the policymakers, a majority of respondents think the president and Congress are doing a poor job. It's 54% think the president, Obama, is doing a poor job in improving the lives of Iraq and Afghanistan veterans. 69% think that about Congress.
Yeah, Washington's not listening, and they're not getting the job done. Even after the VA scandal, there's been tons of rhetoric out of Washington. We've all heard about this magic bullet that was supposed to come from Bernie Sanders and John McCain, and today we see why it's stalled. They can't get along and get things done. So it's really paralyzed our ability to respond, not just at VA, but also at the Department of Defense, for other government agencies. About 1/3 of our members actually work in the federal government or in local government in some way. So there's a huge role for Washington to play here. But the bottom line is the president's not listening. He's not responding. He hasn't talked about the VA scandal directly to veterans in months. He hasn't been meeting with veterans. And we hope that this survey lands on his desk tomorrow. It should be mandatory reading for him and anyone else in this country who cares about the future of our veterans.
Well, and there is the person that the president has nominated to replace Eric Shinseki at the Department of Veterans Affairs. That would be Robert McDonald, who testified at his confirmation hearing before the Senate Veteran Affairs Committee earlier this week. He's the former CEO of Procter & Gamble. He's a former Army captain. Let's listen to a little bit of what he said to the committee.
I think there's no higher calling, and this is an opportunity for me to make a difference in the lives of the veterans who I care so deeply about. If not me, who?
Now, the committee vote was unanimous, and he is expected to be confirmed by the full Senate. But what do you think of Robert McDonald?
Well, I actually spoke to Mr. McDonald last week. He reached out, gave me his cell phone number. I'm encouraged by his attitude. I'm encouraged by his fortitude and his energy. But if he's not supported by Congress and by the president, he's going to have a really hard time. Superman can't do this job if he doesn't get the right resources. And we're even seeing today the Veterans Affairs Committee is paralyzed by infighting and by their inability to truly support the VA or even understand the budgetary challenge that Mr. McDonald will face. So we hope he's confirmed quickly. We don't know if he will be. Hopefully that'll happen before the August break. But we've only got about, 20 working days left in Congress for them to get a lot done, not just on McDonald, but on overall VA reform. So we're not optimistic, but we're hoping that this survey will really encourage people to call their leaders and make them put veterans at the front of the queue when it comes to legislation.
Not to mention all the other things that Congress has to do before they leave town or perhaps once they get back. Paul, one more thing I want to ask you about. 88% of the vets in your survey said they are worried that the end of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan are going to mean that the public are going to pay even less attention to veterans' issues.
Absolutely. I mean, we look to our brothers and sisters from Vietnam, and we're worried about being left in the rearview mirror. We know it's a hot topic right now, but we know Afghanistan will likely wind down in the next year or so, and we're worried about being forgotten. Every generation is always concerned about it, and we've already got challenges. There's not enough philanthropy. There's not enough government support. So it's critical to us that as the wars wind down, they understand our veterans' challenges are just beginning. Here in Boston, nationwide, our veterans need long-term support, and that will require decades of commitment and focus.
Paul Rykoff, founder and CEO of Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America. And you can read the findings from their survey, some fascinating findings of the survey out today. It's at our website, hereandnow.org. Paul, thank you so much as always.
Thank you, Jeremy. Appreciate it.
Why have some of the best recent movies been given such short shrift? Take Bong Joon-ho's new film, Snowpiercer. The movie takes place in a future ice age where the humans who remain are crowded onto one high-speed train run by a wealthy industrialist. They're divided between the haves and the have-nots, and the haves ride in first class. The have-nots are crowded in squalor. But those have-nots begin a rebellion against the train's founder, and as we hear in this scene, the reprisals are brutal.
In front of our hallowed water supply section, no less, you repay his kindness with violent hooliganism. You scum! Precisely 74% of you shall die.
Well, despite much critical acclaim, Snowpiercer hasn't been shown in all that many theaters. And that's a shame, according to Boston Globe film critic Ty Burr, who says that some really good films have been overlooked by movie theater bookers and by audiences. Ty joins us in the studio to talk about a few of his favorites. Ty, welcome back.
Thanks.
So first of all, let's talk a little bit more about Snowpiercer. Why has this film been so overlooked?
Well, it depends on who you ask. This movie was made by Bong Joon-ho. Harvey Weinstein of Weinstein Company bought the rights, took a look at the finished film, said, no, I'm not going to give this a full release. It's too dark. It's too arty. It won't be understood in Peoria. And a lot of people accused him of sort of sitting on it and putting it out only on in art house theaters and also giving it to the subsidiary of his, which puts things out on demand early. And once you put something out on demand early, a lot of movie theaters will not play it. He and his company would argue and have argued, well, we're doing innovative releasing strategies here. And in fact, Snowpiercer came out onto On Demand 2 weeks after it hit theaters and has made a ton of money on demand. So they would argue they're doing something right.
That is one of the ways to see these films now once they sort of fall out of distribution favor, if I can put it that way.
It's true. And the landscape is changing in spite of movie theater owners, the exhibitors, resisting it and holding on to that 90-day window. They don't want movies to show up when they're showing it. But there are inroads being made. And I think like 5 years from now, the landscape may look very, very different. And also it points out the fact that the box office has been really, really down this summer. And people are wondering why. And one reason is that they're able to watch a lot of things at home and are actually happier to watch them at home.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about another one of your favorite overlooked films of the year. It's The Immigrant, starring Oscar-winning actress Marion Cotillard. Tell us about that.
This is a movie that I think is wonderful. It's not for everybody, but it is an absolute gem. It has tremendous cast. It has Marion Cotillard. It has Joaquin Phoenix doing his Joaquin Phoenix thing. It's set in the 1920s. It's about Marion Cotillard as a immigrant from Europe who arrives through Ellis Island, the classic trajectory, with her sister. And actually, there's a scene here I think you have of her coming on the boat and dealing with Joaquin Phoenix.
What's the matter?
I leave my sister here.
Do not worry. She's going to get the best medical care available. Do you have a place to stay?
No. Do you know somewhere?
Yeah, I know a place. If you'd like, I can take you there. Yes?
This is old school classic filmmaking, and it just tore me up. I've seen this movie twice, and I'm a wreck at the end. It's got tremendous performances. It is heartbreaking. It is beautifully shot. The music, as you can hear, is gorgeous. I don't understand why Weinstein, again, is not pushing this film. It's out of theaters now. It's not on demand. It's kind of in limbo. Where is this movie? It really deserves to be seen.
Well, that's high praise indeed. And now I got to add it to my list of things to see, Ty. Then there's also another movie on your list that just sounds really interesting, Fading Gigolo.
Yeah. Well, this is a movie that stars and is written by and directed by John Turturro. And a lot of people are thinking of it as a Woody Allen movie because he plays a supporting role. But really, it's a Turturro movie. And he plays a character, a typical Manhattan middle-aged schnook who's worked in a bookstore that's just closed, who has a second job as a florist. And the bookstore owner, who's played by Woody Allen, decides that to help him out, he's going to become his pimp. So why don't we listen to that scene?
You need a guy like Tom Ford or George Clooney. You're not that. You're a man's man in a certain way. You know... You're not afraid to get dirty. You get your hands dirty. You're working with plants, earth. You're with wires and plumbing and drain pipes and bowls. You know, you do disgusting work. You're not afraid. Hey, you're disgusting in a very positive way.
It sounds like it's going to be like a silly farce. It's not. It actually ends up being kind of a touching romantic comedy drama.
So why do you think then that this film hasn't had more support or wider distribution? I mean, it sounds so engaging.
It is engaging. People who've seen it really like it a lot. I think one of the issues is that the studio pushed it as a Woody Allen film because he's more recognizable than John Turturro. And Woody Allen right now is kind of a qualified liability in the culture for a variety of reasons. Mm-hmm. And I also think it's hard to tell what this movie is. Is it a farce? Is it a drama? This is the wonder of independent film. They're all unique. They kind of all go their own way. When they work well. This one works well.
Okay. So there's one last film that I want to talk about because when I saw it on your list, it kind of surprised me. It's in a totally different genre.
Yep.
Sci-fi film Edge of Tomorrow, starring Tom Cruise, set in the future. Humans are at war with aliens. And Cruise plays an officer who relives a pivotal battle over and over and over again. And as one of our producers called it, it's sort of a sci-fi version of Groundhog Day. And Emily Blunt, I believe, plays a fellow soldier who tells him the benefits that you get new chances to turn the tide of the battle in this case. But there's also a catch, and we've got a scene here, so let's listen.
You get injured on the field, you better make sure you die.
Why?
Last time I was in combat, I was hit. I was bleeding out, just not fast enough. I woke up in a field hospital with 3 pints of someone else's blood, and I was out. I lost the power. Do you understand?
Now, Ty, I was interested to see this film on your list because I remember posters and billboards. I mean, it seems right. Like it had a lot of studio support.
Why am I putting a Tom Cruise movie on a list of the overlooked films of the year? First of all, this is not a movie aimed at the art house crowd. The people who are into Wes Anderson are not going to go see this. The people who are going to see this, potentially, are the mainstream audiences. What we are learning, especially in this time of falling box office, is that they will go see sequels, prequels, pre-sold things. They won't go see an original story. Uh-huh. And they won't go see, you know, Tom Cruise, he's still a movie star, but it's got to be Mission Impossible, or they're not necessarily going to go. Now, the catch is, this is a really good popcorn movie. It's not absurdly violent, but it pays off on that big budget summer movie level. It's a good movie, and it's not being really sort of recognized as such.
Interesting. So this says more about viewers' habits today than it does about studio support.
Yeah, you know, in fact, I would argue that this movie is probably going to be seen much more on demand because people say, oh, yeah, Tom Cruise, I'll dial that up tonight. But they're not going to pay $12 to go see it in a movie theater.
Maybe to ride on the sequel bandwagon, they should have called it Edge of the Day After Tomorrow.
There you go. Edge of Tomorrow 2. Just don't tell anybody that there was an original movie.
Well, we've been talking about films that came and went and maybe shouldn't have gone so fast, but you can still see them, many of them, on demand because they're worth it, according to Boston Globe film critic Ty Burr. And we'll have a list of the films we've talked about, plus some others you might want to check out at hereandnow.org. Ty, it's great to talk to you. Thank you, as always.
Thanks, Magda. Nice to be here.
And when you're at our website, drop us a line and let us know what movies you think have been overlooked and are worth adding to our watch list. Again, that's at hereandnow.org.
You know, I don't even have time to go to the theater right now because I'm so busy catching up on Game of Thrones. I'm behind, but I'm getting there. I just finished season 2, and for anybody who hasn't seen it, I will not even tell you what's happening at that point because a lot has happened.
No spoilers.
No spoilers. Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Here and Now.